Hello, everyone, and welcome to Wild Horse and Burro Radio, an educational outreach program of Wild Horse Freedom Federation. We invite you to call in with any comments or questions you may have for our guests during the second half of the show. Before I introduce my guest, I'm going to make a comment about this House Appropriations Committee vote today, the ban on slaughtering horses at meat processing plants. There was a move to renew the slaughter ban pushed by California Democrat Lucille Roybal-Allard, but it was defeated by a 27-25 vote. And I just want, we're all sick about it, but, you know, we're not going to give up the fight. And just know that all of the organizations are, you know, working together. We're all communicating, and we're not giving up the fight. So I just wanted to say that at the beginning of the show. Our guest tonight is Gail Hunt, president and founder of the Central Oregon Wild Horse Coalition, a nonprofit organization that's been trying to preserve the wild horses currently on the Big Summit HMA in the Echoco National Forest in Oregon. Welcome to the show, Gail.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And thanks also for that update on the House vote. Definitely wasn't the answer we wanted, and I know that we can count on each other as never before to relieve ourselves of the fragmentation we've experienced on some other issues and fight like we've never fought before. Count us in, and we will do whatever it takes to get this thing beat.
Yeah. Well, we're all feeling that way. We're all, you know, we'll be working together on this. So can you tell us a little bit about your background and why you founded the Central Oregon Wild Horse Coalition?
Well, I'm just an incredibly average person with nothing special and not getting any better with age. So I don't have any credentials that are especially remarkable. I just I can't say what my background is without also saying that I have 27 years with the USDA Forest Service, and I got out honorably, and I wondered sometimes if I would. But in the course of supporting the resource folks in a more administrative type position, I've always worked on small forests, and even though that may not be your job to get out there and manage wild horses, you see everything, you hear everything, you read everything. Okay. And in the early 2000s, it was really important to do something different than status quo. Mm-hmm. The Forest Service is a great agency, and I still catch myself saying we instead of they a lot, and that's a mm-hmm. good thing. They do some good things. They just don't necessarily do horses.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we got started in 2002, and it wasn't really under animosity conditions. It was just we could offer some supportive functions that they weren't really tasked to do either by desire or funding. And we could kind of mm-hmm. fill in that gap. And I think that for the most part, we did a good job of working together.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about the Big Summit Wild Horses? Tell everybody a little bit about them.
First of all, you have to imagine the most picturesque, lush, emerald green, open pine forest you can. And that's the Big Summit Ranger District, what used to be Big Summit Ranger District of the Lookout Mountain District, now Ochoco National Forest. And then put some beautiful bay and black and Sabino-colored horses in that environment. And you've just got the most incredible vision you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what they look like, that's where they live, and that makes their management challenges different than probably any other herd in the country, if not the world. Their mm-hmm. background is, and we had to endure this for years, that it's just, you know, the remnant of everybody's horses turned loose. And while that may be true to us to some extent, what those folks don't realize is that when Europeans settled the West as if it were unsettled without us, they all got the horses from the same place, and that's the wild. And mm-hmm. so these horses show a lot of Lusitano and Andalusian in their background. And in addition to that, we have a geneticist out of Florida International University that's done some mitochondrial studies that show that our horses here in little old Prineville, Oregon, descend from only 2 of 77 founding original ancient mares.
Wow.
So they're very unique in that, and Dr. Mills has said that when she does this sort of test on a sampling, usually as many samples as you get is about how many mares are represented, but we're very, very light in that department. Only 2 mares contributed to these genes that are at least predominantly found in her type of study.
Mm-hmm. Wow. When we talked, you mentioned that some genetic augmentation has been implemented with the Big Summit horses. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I'm no good at math, but as I can best recall and find in our records, it was about 2010. We had our first major disagreement with the Ochoco folks, who are entirely different people than are there now. And they had promised to capture a couple of bachelors that were outside of their area, but instead they captured a couple of
Are you talking about the Forest Service? Or who are you talking about?
Yes, Forest Service.
Okay, Forest Service. Okay.
So they ended up capturing some horses that we had agreed that they would not capture, and we kind of threw a fit, and they brought them back. But they also brought back a couple of mares from the South Steens HMA, which is kind of a Hollywood herd known for their very approachable, very big and colorful and friendly horses that may or may not have any genetic similarity to ours. But we were so glad to have our horses back, you know, and we didn't really know much. Nobody did. I mean, in that short of time, so much knowledge has progressed forward. But we said, okay, if that'll help, because we already knew that they were somewhat genetically compromised. So that's where they came from. And those 2 mares are producing offspring.
Mm-hmm. Okay, huh. So now what is it? You've got this Forest Service, Ochoco Herd Management Plan revision. What about this plan concerns you for the wild?
So in the interest of time and my monotonous voice not just clouding the real issues, I'm going to get to the main points initially, and then there's lots of minor points too. Mm-hmm. I think our primary concern is right up front, they identify that there has been resource damage occurring, particularly in riparian areas because of horse use. So that statement is made at this stage in the NEPA process, but yet there is no analysis to back up that statement. So first of all, as maybe just an administrative concern, we feel that is a prejudice statement and is something that will prejudice the readers. And we just feel that is unsubstantiated. And in real life, I think that it indicates that the folks on their interdisciplinary team may not be able to recognize what is horse damage and what may be 100-year-old cattle damage or current sheep damage.
Yeah, like they don't know how to tell it apart. And one of my favorite things, too, was I used to read EAs, and I'd see, like, a photograph of, like, a dime or a pen next to some blades of grass. And, like, how do they know what animal did that damage, for one thing? But the other thing is, you know, when I looked at all the other uses in the area, like mining, you know, like, so if you compare that little dime to, like, a big old, pit, you know, it's very skewed their presentation of why they need to remove the horses. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just had to throw that in.
Oh, no, please feel free. The less I'm talking, the better. And another thing that concerns me about their statement regarding horse damage is it even damage? Because in fairness to the ID team members, there isn't any such thing taught in resource school that is anything remotely related to wild horse ecology. I wish there were. Mm-hmm. I wish there were some really objective and deeply analytical ecological data out there, but I don't think that there really is. And and so these guys are doing their best, and I honor that. However, if you see a hole that's full of water and mud near a meadow, is that really damage? or is that an enhancement to a native species that needs that delivery of water to provide them with the minerals and the bug control that they need? And are you factoring in that if they get their water that way and are in turn making it available to other species, are they factoring in that the horses are then probably not walking down to Cram Creek to get a drink because they prefer it in this form?
Mm-hmm.
And further, they're probably going to be digging areas up that aren't even riparian areas until the horses get there and turn them into water sources. And they're doing that year-round. I mean, at least if it's covered with snow, it doesn't serve the purpose. But at almost any temperature, if you find an area where the horses have dug out a water supply, then it's going to be available to everybody year-long. And I don't think those kinds of things are really built into their assessment that the horses are doing all this damage.
They're not. Yeah, they never mention anything good that the horses do for the ecology, and they, you know, seem to blame any little bit of damage on them. So what are
you
some of the other?
You noticed
that. Yeah. So what are some of the other, you know, issues you have with this plan?
Well, of course, our main concern. If nobody responded about any other sub-issue in this whole document, it would be that we're concerned that they're going to really reduce the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the 1975 plan. Yeah, right now it's an AML of 55 to 75, or excuse me, 55 to 65, and that was based on a document that was written in 1975. And I've been in conversation with a gentleman who did that research, and they really didn't have the same marching orders that we would have thought in 2017. They really weren't going out to the entire forest to count horses. They were identifying an area that might make a good territory, and they counted the horses that were within that within a two-month period that they found. And so the number probably isn't valid, and we've cross-checked that with some folks that have lived here their entire lives, and it just doesn't add up. So there's no reason, there's no scientific reason, certainly, why we should be sticking with that number. And and then adding to that, if they want to keep it low and then genetically augment and dilute the uniqueness of this herd and possibly bring in genetics that will be deleterious to these horses that have adapted over who knows how many years to this very environment. I mean, if there aren't even any other environments like this, why would we think that if we go get horses from another herd that they're going to adapt? And there's so many reasons to not genetically augment this herd.
Yeah.
So we need what is genetically viable, and that's 150.
Yeah, a minimum. So yeah,
at a minimum.
By the way, everyone, I on the radio show promo, you'll notice that I gave an email address that you can email your comments. There's an electronic portal. You can mail it snail mail. But when you do make comments, please remember to put things into your own words. Like we'll give you some. We're talking about talking points or things we noticed. You know, be sure and put things. You could add your own personal touch to this and use your own words. But yeah, that's what I thought. Here, they're not even, you know, it's not even a viable herd number now, and you know, so it has to be a minimum of 150 to 200 animals with 50 breeding age adults, and that's very important to remember. And what I talked to Gus Cawthron one time at Texas A&M, and I said, does the BLM tell you about sex ratio skewing or fertility control? And he told me in that phone call they did not. They tell him about the fences and give him some other information. But that's pretty important information to withhold from Dr. Cawthron, you know, for how many of the number they're giving him has been treated with fertility control and how often and the sex ratio skewing. So, you know, I really probably have to file FOIA to find out what information they give him in more detail. But anyhow. Can you tell us a little bit about the horses and water?
It's, you know, it's not really an issue. There are a lot of folks, and Radio Land that could speak to that in a more meaningful way, because water really isn't an issue. You might have some Nevada horses that have to go 20 miles a day for a little drink in a hoof print, but these horses on a bad day might have to go 1 mile.
No, really?
I'm not even sure that they have to go that far. This is a mountain environment. It's just full of springs. There are water developments for the cows and sheep, but there's just plain water everywhere. And the horses know where the good stuff is. So that's really not an issue for us. But were it to become so, I think it's really critically important that it's not always does your horse get a drink within 2 or 3 days like their bodies might require, but what is the long-term effect of not having that water? You know, how much damage are you doing to kidneys and other organs and the general well-being of this horse, subjecting it to diseases more? They're already compromised because of lack of water. I mean, the list goes on once they start to deteriorate because water is so hard to find. May not be a problem on Big Summit, but it certainly is elsewhere.
Well, also, I read something very interesting on your website that I'd never heard before, that if a horse becomes deficient in its water intake, it will stop eating even if there are abundant food sources available. I had never heard that, and then I read it on your website.
Yeah, bad things happen. You just, it's criminal that someone would ever intentionally do that, and I know that even that is done, but it's also criminal if... by neglect, by not paying attention, we also allow that to happen. I don't worry about it here, but I certainly do worry about it elsewhere.
Yeah. Well, I've even been concerned about the bait and water trapping that the Bureau of Land Management does, because, you know, I worry about them fencing the horses off from their water to try and trap them because, you know, none of us are out observing this, and, you know, you don't know how long they're going without drinking or what the circumstances are.
Right.
And it's
right.
Not always as gentle as they, you know, we've seen photographs. It's not always the gentle trapping that it was when Ginger Catherine's was watching in the Pryors. You know, it's a different thing out there. And there's very little accountability. So let's see what else. You've got some really great volunteers that do boots on the ground inventory every year. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, we've probably got a fairly constant number that keeps returning every year to do this, of at least 80 volunteers. Sometimes we get lucky and we get even more than that. We've been doing it, coordinating it with the Forest Service for 16 years now. And we position people in camps to ride a particular unit, and preferably every year the same unit, so that they really get to know the horses, get to know their ways and their landscape. And so we have about 27,000 actual acres of the territory, but we certainly don't stop there. We go everywhere we think there might be a horse.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can't get there on horseback, we'll send some people out on foot. And then... even so, we know that we're not going to find every horse because there's freaking trees every direction you look. And if you don't get lucky and get blessed by God above, then you probably aren't even going to see a swish of a tail. You just really have to know the horse's ways, be persistent, keep returning to that area. And then we couple that with year-round sightings and photographs from public that come directly to us. And so we really juxtapose those two methods, if you will, of the 3-day blitz of the forest with information that we collect all year long. And even so, it's, you know, it is a forest. And in the winter, we can't go there. I mean, I snowshoe, but I've only got 2 feet, and I'm not that good at it. And you just can't cover that much ground, and drones don't really work in the timber. Last year, we didn't even have any good fly days. That was the extent of our winter. It just never left. And so we have some people that are willing to fly low in their aircraft, but between the terrain, the timber, and the weather, you know, there's just a lot of information that we're missing. So we try to get out there as soon as we can and substantiate what we think might be there from previous censuses and go from there. So we don't claim 100% accuracy, but I think given our circumstances, we come pretty close.
Yeah, and you guys have a really great Facebook page with all your little updates and pictures on it. So I encourage everybody to go to the Facebook page for Central Oregon Wild Horse Coalition. We have a new radio guest. Yay, Chester.
Yeah, that would be Chester. I think he's barking at the ravens who are stealing his food from his horse's water trough. I can't do anything about it. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. We're all animal lovers here. So one of your projects is education and, you know, educating the public about the care of wild horses. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
When we started in 2002, one of the first things we got really busy doing was exactly that, both in terms of the public realizing in their own county they had these wild horses. Some people didn't even realize they lived here all their lives. And, of course, wanting to draw people out from surrounding areas in Central Oregon. And then we also wanted to cultivate a really qualified cadre of adopters and teach people how to properly train a wild horse. So we started almost out of the gate doing that sort of thing, and we branched out to try and attract a bigger audience by doing Western arts festivals, music festivals, trail challenges, just horse shows for wild horse owners, and everything we could think of. And I, as much as that was a huge amount of work and financial risk, I missed that. But you know, honestly, now we're lucky if occasionally an elementary school will ask us to bring a wild horse and have a wild horse day. But we've just really been consumed by fighting fights, and we want to win some so we can get back to the fun stuff.
Yeah, I know. I think what I wanted, you know, we had Lynn Nash on talking. You know, she was trying to get a lot of horses adopted and wild horses adopted. And I'm wondering, so say there's somebody out there, they're a horse person, but they've never had a wild horse, and they're thinking about adopting one. What would you tell them about caring for a wild horse? And I also, my next question is going to be about your process with training a wild horse.
Well, I'll answer that question first, because I would never, never, ever call myself a wild horse trainer. I don't think there's ever been a situation where I got to take a fresh horse off the range and start and finish it myself. I get the horses that other people ruin, or for whatever reason, the horse just is not adoptable. And I love that, because you get to pare it down to the real horse underneath all that crust. But I'm not an EMM trainer, and I never would want to be. I would just say that when I'm faced with training a horse of any age in any situation, my goal is to just capitalize on the partnership that is waiting to happen, because that's what's so extraordinary about these guys is you can mess them up all you want, you can abuse them all you want, and they just still want to partner with us. I mean, who does that? So I just have to prove to the horse that I'm not part of that. And they're smart enough and open-minded enough to recognize that. And so I don't have a method as much as I just find something in the horse that is my pathway in. Even if it starts out being an aggressive tendency because they have to be on the defensive because of whatever's happened to them, we can turn that into a curiosity. We can turn that into a desire to be with us. And that's not because I know how to train a horse. That's because wild horses are so incredible. If you just let them, they'll tell you what you need to tell them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're great. Yeah. When you're helping adopt these horses or working at adoption events, do you tell people how to feed them or what any special care they need?
Yeah. And like I said, we haven't really done any clinics for a while for a number of reasons, but we're first of all very selective about the trainers that we get for demos and the trainers that we recommend, and it is absolutely start to finish what you need to know, and are you sure you want to even get into this, and if something goes wrong, call us. We don't leave any stone unturned.
You tell them what kind of food you get.
Yeah. and we're very, very strict on facilities. Well, you know,
the area they're from.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, the horses up in the Ochoco, they have such a wide variety of forage available to them, and it's not all native species, because in the Forest Service, when you do a timber sale, you might want to replant your sale area with whatever grass grows. So there's non-native timothy and orchard grass, some things like that that they're exposed to already. So just about any hay that you could grow here, they're going to already have in their system. So it makes our job really easy. The horses mm-hmm. from desert areas, a little more difficult, but they're all being fed at the stage of adoption at their holding facility. So I would just transition from whatever they're getting into whatever is available where you take the horse.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're coming up on the half.
Key.
Yeah. I'm going to make a quick announcement. We're coming up on the half hour. And if anyone wants to call in with a comment or question for Gail, the call number is 917-388-4520. Then press 1. And actually, Gail, my producer, Marty, let me know that there was somebody waiting to make a comment or ask a question. So, Marty, do we have somebody that wanted to comment or ask a question on?
Yes, you do. You have Sherry. She's live and ready to go.
Okay. Hi, Sherry.
Oh, hi. Great show. This isn't about exactly what you're speaking about, but it's I thought it's an announcement that should go through. It's they're getting ready to round up the horses in the Stinking Water HMA in Oregon, and that's the Bureau of Land Management. And the charts, our statisticians, who are excellent, one in particular has crunched the numbers, and the numbers are completely completely off. Scroll back to 2009, there was supposedly a 21% increase. 2010, it jumped up to 207% increase. And then moving mm-hmm. forward, you've got in 2015, well, go back to 2014, a 21% increase again. And then in 2015, it jumps up to 170% increase.
That must have been one of those years when stallions were having babies.
And twins,
and
twins at that. Okay, the it sounds as though it's possible that they could be looking to zero this HMA out, and the comments will be due on July 26th, and they said they're gonna. I'll just read this one portion of it. This would mean if the horses gathered in the fall of 2017, approximately 270 horses. Roughly 90% of the estimated herd size, based on current estimates, would be gathered using the helicopter drive method. Approximately 267 excess horses would be removed from the Stinking Water HMA that have strayed outside the HMA boundary to reestablish the herd size at the low AML of 40 horses.
Yeah,
that's my announcement.
We'll get something up to get everyone to comment about that. So, you know,
and I have
this week or next week
about
the
appropriations bill. I've been calling, and I found out that quite a few of the congressmen didn't even know that about the appropriations bill or the BLM budgetary request. It was news to them. They didn't know it had been slid in. And the senator,
wow.
Same way. And it wouldn't hurt, like, for instance, Florida's Senator Rubio. I called because the D.C. office was closed. It was the only office I could get anyone to answer, and the man that answered didn't know anything about it. So I'm thinking a lot of them just don't know. They're unaware of it was slid in so cleverly and so deceitfully that you know, I don't know. Is this a done deal now, or is there another vote coming? I'm still green on this stuff.
This is part of a process. So we'll be hearing, I talked with Susan Wagner of Equine Advocates this afternoon. we'll be having a big conference call with probably a lot of the leaders of the group. So you'll be hearing more about it the next few days when people have a chance to write stuff up.
So we should continue. And
the fight will continue. Keep up the phone calls.
Yes. I'm getting to know them first. And on the Stinking Water roundup, Senator Merkley in Oregon does have this information and also has the secret documents of 2008. And I think all of the congressmen should have those. A lot of them, most of them, I don't believe know. And so it's real interesting. You get their attention when, you know, there's that one section that says that they discussed how to keep this from congressional oversight. So they really ought to have these documents. Just wanted to put that out as a public announcement.
Maybe what we could do is have some suggested documents that the public can give to their congressional members. We have another caller on, Sherry. You're welcome to stay on and listen or join back in later if you want. I still have questions for Gail. And I know we have one caller waiting. Marty, can we have him hold on just a few more minutes? I had one other question I wanted to ask my guest first. Gail, can you tell us a little bit about your work with the Florida International University Forensic Institute in developing some genetic sampling techniques?
Sure. And in fact, I really want to talk about that because that whole subject represents a really great time in forest wild horse management, at least locally. We had a person sitting in the head chair over the entire agency's horse program at the time, and she was really interested in developing a censusing method using fecal matter. And so that was Tony Strauss, and she came all the way out here and rode my horse Norton, and we collected poop, and everybody in the census collected poop with their little nitrile gloves and their sanitary stuff. And then we found out that maybe wasn't ready for retail yet, because you get in an herbivore as a horse who doesn't digest everything, you get all this DNA noise from all the other organisms in there. And so Dr. Mills has perfected it, I think, now to where it's almost going to be a very useful tool in the near future. But that's how got to know her, was somehow Tony attracted the attention of the Florida International Forensics Institute, and Dr. Mills was head of the DNA program there, and she is a horse person. And so she came out and also rode Norton, and I can't believe either one of them lived to tell about it. But we got to be close friends, and we've stayed in contact with Dr. Mills, and she's just very dedicated to finding out new things that are available to us through equine DNA. And she's the one who did the mitochondrial study on the ancient mares.
Wow.
And we're not done with
her
because there's a lot more that we want to learn, not just about this herd, but we would like to at some point identify whether we can still find any remnant of the true native North American horse, because I think it's here and I think it may be in the Pacific Northwest. That's a long-term project that we're really interested in.
Yeah. Well, we have a caller waiting, and it's Craig Downer. You want me to call in with a comment? Marty, is Craig on?
Yes, he is.
Hi, Craig.
Hi. Excellent program. I'm learning a lot. I just wanted to say I visited the Big Summit herd management area on the 28th and 29th of April. After
why didn't
I was,
you call me, Craig?
Hi.
How come I didn't hear from you?
Yeah, I should have, definitely.
Yes, you should have.
Yeah, sorry about that. It was a real oversight on my part. But I did have luck when I first entered there in the afternoon. I saw 12. I saw a very dynamic band of 12, and it was they were grazing down, you know, coming up from that campground along the stream, and there was a lot of, you know, the stream was overflowing. There was all kinds of lush grass and. And then, but when I stopped to get out, the about 10 of them, they just dashed up, and then right behind them was this real wiry, thin, tall, dark stallion, which I got really good picture of, several, and he let out a real high-pitched scream, and then they all just scampered right up that mountain, this steep mountain in amid the forest. So that was really exciting. And then I saw a lone stallion, too, right after that, just grazing by the he wasn't as disturbed by my presence, and he was just grazing by the stream. But I did camp out way up there on the edge, up in the north central, and I tried to make the whole loop the following day, but I ran into snow drifts, so I couldn't proceed any further. But as you say, it's a real beautiful area, and I will be giving my input based on what I'm learning now, and I'll check out your website, and I do think that we know everything you say is so true. There should be a lot more of the horses there, and you should strive to preserve that unique lineage, which is adapted to that specific area. That's so important, and not domesticate them. And I think the case can be made in by the Wild Horse and Burro Act that that is the true intention. Doesn't it say they shall be, considered as integral parts of the public land ecosystem? So
Amen.
We shouldn't, ignore that, and keep up your great work. It's really great. So I look forward to going up there again. So maybe you'll see me pretty soon.
You better call me next time, Craig.
Okay.
I'm going to be so ticked if you don't.
Yeah, I know
Craig,
that.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that you appreciate our horses too, and you really got a great sampling of both their habitat and who they are, because there is still snow on the ground in April, and if there's time, that really should generate a little more conversation about the challenges they face and why we still think they should be in higher numbers than they are.
Yeah, absolutely. That 50, whatever it is, to 65, that's just so unfair. And now, we should always insist that the relative proportions of the grazing allocation be fully revealed as far as the forage allocation. That's so important. So, yeah, a real exciting herd, and congratulations. So I look forward to coming up, and I'll just get through your website. I'll get your contact information, right?
All right, yes.
Yeah.
Craig, if you want to stay on the line and listen, and then maybe later on in the show join back in, you can. We might touch on some topics.
Sure.
I'm going to be on listen,
definitely. Wouldn't miss this. And I just wanted to say I was so impressed with how elegant these horses were, and energetic. They were quite distinctive, I thought, quite distinctive lineage of wild horses.
Well, thank you, Craig. That means a lot coming to you, and I'll share that with them.
Like to see the Andalusian, characteristics. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them I saw were pretty dark, but one thing that, they did seem quite frightened, and do you have any comment on that as to why they were frightened of me?
Just having a bad mane day, because I don't know why they'd be frightened of you, Craig. We're getting a lot of pushback from the agency to just the opposite of that, in that they feel that some of these horses are getting too domesticated, and not to open another can of worms, but there was a little bit of emergency feeding going on by the public, prohibited by the agency, and their claim was that it domesticates them, which it does not. But even without that issue, these horses are just born domesticated. They can't help themselves. I don't know what their problem was when you saw them, but horses
yeah,
that,
maybe
that
there was
are
a
out in the hinterland
around.
Of this Who knows?
Yeah.
But horses that just don't see people very often are just unsullied by mistreatment from people. And so the wildest of our horses out there, still, if you just kind of don't even approach them, don't even look at them, don't even talk to them, you can turn your back and they will be in your pocket, because that's also who they are. there's a real paradox there, but they are in no way domesticated animals. That's just their nature.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Well, I'm really looking forward to going, you know, to getting to know them better and then to write a really good input and become involved there in their defense.
Good.
And you know, I'm really interested, too, in checking out those genetic studies that have been done you're talking about.
Okay.
Well,
and
another
yeah,
thing,
well,
you know, it's so critical, too, for the masculine genetic variety, which is great in horses. And so you were right on, you know, insisting about those bachelors going back to the herd. It's among horses
yeah, well,
in general, the masculine genetic diversity is really imperiled,
sure.
You know.
Right.
Yeah, it's good to know that. I think we have Craig. We've got another caller on, so I'm going to take another caller real quick, and then we'll get back to more questions for Gail. Marty, do we have another caller?
Yes, you do. You have Mary on. Mary, you're live and on the air.
Okay.
Hi.
Hi, Mary.
Hi. Going back to the legislation and the point that was made about perhaps these people in the offices of the senators and whatever. Aren't aware of the situation. What I think is missing is lobbying. Can't we get some people to work or be instructed by an organization like the ASPCA or?
Well, we had a lobbyist for the ASPCA last Saturday. We had Kate Crosco was on,
and I listened to that, and it was very interesting. But I'm saying maybe that's where we really need the outreach, and if we could be trained, then we could, you know, that it's not rocket science. We could do
That's a good idea, Mary, and we're actually going to have a. You know, of course, all the groups are communicating about this, and we're going to be discussing strategies, so I'll be sure and bring that up. That's a great idea. And we need, you know, if anybody has input, you know, be sure, and you can always mail me at debbie@wildhorsefreedomfederation.org. We appreciate any ideas people have. You know, we're all fighting to try and save our horses, so. But thank you for calling in with that idea, Mary. I like it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So anyhow, Gail, can you tell us there was a trend of some physical anomalies in the herd that led to testing? And can you tell us about that and what you found?
Yeah, this is all tied to the many reasons why we want to see the herd numbers go up, and we just want to see some really close oversight on this herd. I don't know how long, because I've only been following them 20, maybe 25 years, but I don't know if it occurred before then. But what we see too much of here is a fracture of the hind fetlock joints. And the corral manager at the Burns BLM corral, who used to do all the Forest Service processing, she says she doesn't ever see that in any other herd. And it can just be heartrending when you see a young horse that is packing his hind leg and the fetlock joint swollen. And so what we have started to do is whether we can get a live horse and salvage it, or if we have to rely on the necropsy. We have got a team of veterinarians that is beginning to work on this with very limited material to work with, but they are finding that there is a bone structural issue, very definitely. Mm.
And
then you combine that
huh?
with, well, not necessarily, and that's what we're trying to ascertain. I think it would be a safe assumption to believe that there's at least a 50-50 chance that it is genetic rather than environmental or possibly a combination. But we certainly don't want to let this herd shrink down again now that we've got it close to the size that we're thinking is optimal, because that is just very high risk. It just doesn't need to happen. And then you intensify that that predisposition with the terrain and the fact that this is also a national forest that strives toward healthy forests. And so you've got a lot of thinning, logging operations going on. So you've got steep slopes, young foals, and a lot of deadfall or thinning slash that they're getting hung up in. And it's something that we really, really need to get on top of. And it could be also something that is environmental. Pardon me?
Yeah. And if it is environmental, do you think the timber industry would be willing to work with you and make accommodations, or is there anything they could do?
It's not so much the timber industry as it's the people managing the forest. And that is also an issue, not coincidentally, with winter forage availability. They've made the statement, too, that there is not sufficient winter forage. Well, yeah, there is. And there'd be even more if we could somehow take care of the on-the-ground slash that is not being treated, especially that occurs in their winter range. There are acres and acres right now of down slash that is preventing any forage from growing. So that is going to be built into our response, because it's not only a hazard, it's preventing them from getting full benefit of their limited winter range. So we would definitely like to see these numbers go up, because the only reason we have a genetic problem right now is because in 1992-93 we had a bottleneck event where horses perished in great numbers, and that created this genetic problem that we're now seeing. And if we have a low number, we don't want it to happen again.
Yeah.
We can't afford that.
It could be a total wipeout,
Right. We need to have not just genetic diversity. Excuse me. What?
Go ahead.
We don't just need the larger numbers for genetic diversity. We need just purely numbers resiliency, because we aren't just facing our own internal issues with them. We've got wolves now we didn't used to have. We've got the public who is just unforgivably stupid about disease control, and we've had an outbreak of N1 and EHV1 in recent years, where the biosecurity practiced in the community was just almost non-existent. And all
so somebody
run
their
footprint, one germ, and they're wiped out. So there are many, many reasons why we need to build numbers resiliency as well as just genetic diversity.
So anyhow, when that happened, somebody rode their domestic horse that was maybe sick out there.
It wouldn't
like
even
that
take
happened?
That. It could just be somebody's dog or somebody's footprints or somebody's tire tracks or somebody's clothing. And these horses have no immunity to that. And we're not, you know, like the Reno herds, the Virginia range herds, where we're right outside a big city, but we're outside of a very rural-based, horse-oriented community in Central Oregon. And a lot of them do come to the herd management area or the territory expecting to see horses, and it wouldn't take much at all to wipe them out. And then of course you know, they've made it through the winter thus far, even though last winter was one of the worst on record, but maybe next year we're going to have one that's even more intractable. If we don't have the numbers, then we cannot protect the future of these horses.
That's why it's so important for all of our listeners out there. Please comment and please ask for the minimum viable herd number, which is 150 to 200 with 50 breeding age adults. So please help us out. You know, the more people that do it, they know that people care about it and they're watching what's going on. Another thing I wanted to bring up, Gail, that is also in 2013, six wild horses were shot there in the Choco National Forest. And I think even back in 2011, there were also horses shot. So can you tell us a little bit about that? Were the killers ever caught?
They're never caught. They're never caught. One exception to that was somebody during bow hunting season got one, and it was not even a wild horse. It was a trespass horse. There was a prosecution then, but we have a different set of law enforcement protocols just by virtue of who's prosecuting the cases now as opposed to then. And it's nobody wants to rat out the guys who did it. There's people who don't like the horses because of cows and sheep, and there's people who don't like the horses because of deer and elk, and there's people who don't like the horses just because they don't like themselves. And I wouldn't even put it in any particular order. There's just people who don't value horse life, and there's not a lot we can do to prevent that.
That's pretty upsetting.
Yeah, it is, especially when you got your hands up to your elbows trying to find the ballistics, and when you knew those horses in particular, and then that happens to them.
Yeah, I'd be heartbroken. Yeah. Well, I have one. This is the question that I was looking forward to asking you. What do you like most about? I always like to ask this question to people that have been around them a lot, or, you know.
And, you know, I don't think it's necessarily because people who love wild horses are all just inarticulate like I might be. It's really personal, and so we might have trouble articulating it. And so I would say that on two fronts, I just find them incredible beings. And I mean, if I can revel in the spectacular nature of the neighbors' wild and free roaming banty roosters that come up on my porch, because they are so freaking intelligent and entertaining, I can certainly see that in a wild horse. They just embody nature, natural intelligence, and not just reactivity, but they think out their problems and they plan, and they're not just sentient, they're caring, they're noble. They care about sheep in Reno that their herd got burned up, and they take one sheep into their band and make sure that it has every privilege that a horse would have. I mean, that's nobility. So I love all those things about them, but there's something that's even more personal, and that is, and this is what got me really hooked, is when I lived up there and I saw the horses when I'd go running with my dogs. The horses don't care if you've got a college degree or if your hair's sticking up. They don't care about your past. They don't care about anything but who you are at the moment. And if I might say something that I hope won't be offensive, they see me as God sees me, as pure, unadulterated, unruined. And there isn't a being on the face of the earth, not even a dog, who sees you quite like that. And and that's pretty hard to argue with. And so that's why I want to make sure that they are protected to the ends of the earth.
Well,
I mean, people think that they have to earn their right to exist out there somehow by having a value or for doing something for us, for earning their way. No, they don't. They just deserve to live, period.
I like that. That's a great thought, and I'm glad you brought it up, because I think a lot of times they get attacked so much we feel we have to try and defend them with, well, they do this, they do that, and, you know, they don't do this, they don't do that, but they're, you know, they're part of the nature, the balance of things. You know, that's
exactly.
That's why they're here. Yeah. Well, we're coming up on the last 5 minutes of the show. Again, I'm going to encourage everyone, look at the radio show promo. There's an email address on there. Please send some comments and ask them, the Forest Service, to make sure that they have a viable herd number, a minimum of 150 to 200 wild horses with 50 breeding age adults. Anything less is unacceptable, and especially considering, you know, all the issues that Gail brought up, disease, bad winters, bad weather, you know, so put things in your own words, but please take a few minutes to send an email. Gail, is there anything we didn't talk about that you wanted to bring up before I start signing off?
Oh, there's just lots of items I had highlighted in here that are troublesome to us, but I think if we just really focus on the numbers and don't fall for this, we don't have the land to support it. We do. If that were not so, then why do we have 140 horses that came out of the winter of 2017? I mean, it was the worst. It was just intractable, would not would not go away, sun would not shine, and yet that's how many horses came out of that winter. So, yes, we can do it, particularly if we pay more attention to their winter range and make it as optimal for the horses as we can.
Since I also have my little callers, Craig and Sherry, are you both still there? Did you want to make a quick comment before I start my sign-off?
I can. If Sherry doesn't want to go in front of me. I just say that that number for viability, I would be careful about that because that could be shortchanging them. You have to, each herd is unique and you have to test.
Well, and yeah, and it's a minimum number. I said a minimum. Yeah.
Yeah, I just wouldn't use it like blanket in a blanket way. Because actually that equid specialist group recommended in the wild a interbreeding population of 2,500. In their action plan for equid species.
I'd like to read that, Craig. If you could email it to me, I'd like to read that. Thank you.
Yeah, that was public too.
Okay. Yeah, we're kind of starting to run out of time here, but I'd like to thank Gail for being on the show. Thank our callers for calling in. Even Mary with the great idea. We appreciate getting those ideas. I'd like to remind everybody that you can get updates about the wild horses of the Big Summit HMA on the Central Oregon Wild Horse Coalition Facebook page. And I liked it that so many people were taking pictures of the horses and what's going on. So I think you guys would enjoy that Facebook page. So Gail, thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, you know what? I kind of surprised myself, and I'm going to have to say the pleasure was all mine.
Oh, good.
I thought it would be horrible, but, you know, how can you beat getting to talk to all these folks who love the horses as much as we do?
Let's
just not give up the fight.
We won't. I'd like to also...
A wonderful statement you made about why you value the horses in their own right. I really appreciate that, Gail.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Craig.
Me too. That was really great, Gail. I'd like to thank our producer, Marty Oakley, and tell everyone about two other shows we have on TS Radio. There's Voices Carry for Animals, hosted by Debbie Dahmer on Tuesday nights, and then a show called Whistleblowers, hosted by Marty Oakley on Thursday nights. And our producer, Marty, is also hosting a panel at the end of the month at the Whistleblowers Summit in Washington, D.C. And I'd like to point out, in case everybody didn't know, that the National Whistleblower Center has a global wildlife whistleblower program to report illegal wildlife trafficking and other wildlife crimes. So check out their website at the National Whistleblower Center. So thanks, Gail. Thanks to all of you that were listening tonight. And we'll be back with another show really soon. Good night, everyone.
All right.